How many of you have already studied Second Canto? Nobody. Okay. When I was here, did I cover chapter 3? No. Huh?
Chapter 4, and you covered parts of chapter 4.
Parts of chapter 4. Okay, maybe it's because when I was in Delhi, I covered chapter 3. Perhaps. Chapter 4 is the process of creation. Well, I've not prepared anything, so we could start anywhere. I'll just go ahead with chapter 9. Chapter 9 is entitled Answers by Citing the Lord's Version. And most notable about chapter 9 is the Chatur Shloki verses of Srimad Bhagavatam are found there. Chatur Shloki verses. Yeah, they're there. So Chatur Shloki verses are the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam summarized. The Chatur Shloki verses are what Shukadev Goswami heard from his father Vyasadeva while he was still within the womb. It's the Chatur Shloki verses that were part of the original compilation of the Bhagavat Purana when Vyasadeva had completed compiling all the Puranas. And then, as we find in the first canto, the instructions by Narada to expand that in the form of the 18,000 shlokas. Which is, so the 18,000 shlokas come from the four. And this chapter is preceded by a whole, the questions of Maharaj Parikshit. And this is the answers. So it would make sense to cover the questions before covering the answers, but it's not that exactly. It's a one-to-one correlation, nor is it that all the questions are exhaustively answered in chapter 9 from chapter 8, but rather so much of the rest of Srimad Bhagavatam is a response to those questions. They're good questions. Sometimes devotees wonder what's a good question to ask. So read chapter 8, you'll find some good questions to ask. The Bhagavatam itself is like many scriptures, it's questions and answers. And spiritual association is often simply on that basis, questions and answers. And even if the questions are something that one already has some understanding of, let's say amongst peers, peers, whether they're, whatever their level of spiritual advancement, peers may also enter into a discussion where there's a topic that's posed, and you know, how would you view this question? And then a response comes, and then it creates the medium for Krishna Katha, questions and answers. So that's what the Bhagavatam is, questions and answers. In the first canto, there's the six questions found in chapter 1, and then the six answers that come in chapter 2 and 3. And from what is said with the answers, it leads to more questions, which leads to more answers, which leads to more questions. So in that way, the whole Bhagavatam is constructed. In this second canto, so second canto begins with Shukadeva Goswami beginning to speak, because at the final chapter of canto 1, Shukadeva Goswami appears at the assembly of the sages of Naimisharanya, and his glories are described, how he's received is described. The questions that are put to him by the sages and by Maharaj Parikshit is described, and Shukadeva Goswami gets ready to narrate. That ends Canto 1. Canto 2 is the direct dialogue. So before that, it's Sutta summarizing things that he heard. And that's quite common also for a text, that you, before you lay everything out in detail, you present a short summary, and then you go into, start going into detail, and at the end, summary. Srimad Bhagavatam is composed like that also. The first and second canto, Prabhupada describes in the second canto, in a one purport, that they are meditation upon the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Just like when approaching the deity, specifically it's mentioned in relation to deity worship section in chapter 3 of this canto. There's some discussion about deity worship, and one approaches the deity in that way also. Actually, first through the spiritual master, one then approaches the deity and takes darshan of the lotus feet, and gradually rising to the lotus face of the Supreme Lord in his deity form. Srimad Bhagavatam is also like that. First and second cantos are like taking shelter of the Lord's lotus feet through sound vibration. And Prabhupada said that in these first two cantos, he even said in the first canto, but in these first two cantos, he also said, everything that you need to go back to Godhead is there. So, it's filled with very compact instructions. Following the second canto, the narration of lives of kings and so many other, the history part unfolds more. The first two cantos are more very strong philosophical statements, clustered in groups and building a very broad picture of a foundation of sambandha gyan, basically. the understanding of the identity of the personality of Godhead and things in relation to Him, just like in this earlier chapters of this. Well, just in sequence, the first. This is not a total comprehensive picture, but first step in God realization is the first chapter, and that is enabling persons who have no personal conception of God to examine things that they can see with their eyes and their senses, and put that sense perception in the frame of a personal conception of God. So the Virat Rupa, which is not identical with the 11th chapter Bhagavad Gita Virat Rupa, but it's an imaginary form of the Lord seeing things within nature in relation to God as a person. And following that is the process of meditation, of course sprinkled with very wonderful instructions about renunciation, detachment, simple living, breaking the material conception and replacing it with a spiritual conception. Very strong language Shukadeva Goswami is using in that regard. And then the third chapter is pure devotional service, following identifying the Supreme within the heart, with detailed description of the Lord, how He appears situated within the heart, then rendering of unalloyed devotional service, and again mixed with some very strong language about detachment, renunciation. And then following that is the process of creation. Lord Brahma's talks with, or Narada's talks with Brahma, Brahma's unfolding of the creation. So we get a picture of the material ingredients and how they relate to Brahma and how Brahma relates to the Supreme Lord. So we get that picture, Sarga and Visarga. Not in great detail, but in greater detail will be presented a couple more times in the Bhagavatam, but an introduction to all of that. And then this nice chapter that where Maharaj Parikshit, Purusha Sukta confirmed. Again, that's Purusha Sukta is in relation to creation. It's identifying its prayers to the Purusha avatars who take responsibility for the matters of the material world, creating and sustaining the material world. So they're approached through the Purusha Sukta prayers. And then again a summary, very nice actually, summary of incarnations is presented, as was done in chapter 3 of the first canto. Again it comes in chapter 7 of the second canto. It expands a little bit, especially some very, very nice verses describing Krishna's pastimes in a summary way. Actually, it goes even in a very delightful, wonderful way, even into other chapters besides chapter 3, where in Kunti's prayers and Bhishma's instructions to Yudhisthira, sprinklings of Krishna's pastimes are appearing. And a little more extensively in chapter 7. And then in chapter 8, Maharaj Parikshit asks, the whole chapter is just asking questions. And so we're going to discuss chapter 9. In response to his questions, Shukadeva Goswami goes back, not surprisingly, to some very fundamental conceptions of the self. Meaning, he establishes spiritual conceptions. Because one can hear high understandings or high philosophy and not receive it properly if one is hearing it with material conception. So it's repeated and repeated and repeated, but here it's early on in the Bhagavatam, so naturally it's there. I think because I'm not prepared to summarize, because I didn't look at the verse, I'll just read. King Prikshit inquired from Shukadeva Goswami, Brahmana chodito brahman guna kyane gunasyacha yasma yasma tata praha narado devadarshanaha. Maharaj Prikshit wanted to know from Shukadeva, how did Narada Muni, whose hearers are as fortunate as those instructed by Lord Brahma, explain the transcendental qualities of the Lord who is without material qualities, and before whom did he speak? Purport, Devarshi Narada was directly instructed by Brahmaji, who was also directly instructed by the Supreme Lord. Therefore, the instructions imparted by Narada to his various disciples are as good as those of the Supreme Lord. This is the way of understanding Vedic knowledge. It comes down from the Lord by disciplic succession, and this transcendental knowledge is distributed to the world by this descending process. There is no chance, however, to receive the Vedic knowledge from mental speculators. Therefore, wherever Narada Muni goes, he represents himself as authorized by the Lord, and his appearance is as good as that of the Supreme Lord. Similarly, the disciplic succession, which strictly follows the transcendental instruction, is the bona fide chain of disciplic succession and the test for such bona fide spiritual masters is that there should be no difference between the instruction of the Lord originally imparted to his devotees and that which is imparted by the authority in the line of disciplic succession. How Narada Muni distributed the transcendental knowledge of the Lord will be explained in later cantos. Although it seems that that's what the question is being asked, how did he distribute the knowledge? Prabhupada is saying, well, that answer will come later, but it's specifically what messages did he pass on? What were the points of emphasis of Narada as he heard it from Brahma and then repeated it to others? It will appear also that the Lord existed prior to the material creation, and therefore his transcendental name, quality, etc. do not represent any material quality. Whenever, therefore, the Lord is described as aguna, or without any quality, as in this verse, it does not mean that he has no quality, but that he has no material quality, such as the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance, as the conditioned souls have. So, this in the Upanishads, this is a big issue: aguna and saguna, or nirguna and saguna, as forms of worship. And from the Vaishnava point of view, we can say, we can explain how the terms nirguna, as it's done here, or aguna, apply to worship of the Supreme Lord who has no material qualities. And saguna means with spiritual qualities, but one can also take it the other way. The impersonalists take it that Nirguna means the undifferentiated Brahman, and Saguna means worshipping something material. And that might be appropriate in certain circumstances, but when it's addressing worship of the Supreme, we should understand what it means. Although it does have qualities, and they're not material. A little anecdote. When I was visiting Anshu at Champaign-Urbana, we had three evenings of classes, and the third one was a very general one, something about karma and reincarnation, spiritual perspective. So two of the classes, this was the third class, two of the classes, an Indian couple, I guess they were boyfriend, girlfriend, but maybe they were married, I don't know. And they brought a friend the third day, and the friend was the girl's classmate, who was Oriental. I don't know what country, but Oriental. And so at the very beginning, before we started, I wanted her to feel comfortable sitting with people that she might otherwise not feel comfortable with. So some light conversation about your friends with these, since it was identified to her classmate. She said, maybe you could do me a favor. Your upbringing was probably Buddhist. She said, oh yes. So why don't you listen very carefully to the discussion and let me know what things you found to be very, very similar to your understandings and what things you found to be dissimilar. She smiled. She was very happy. It's just a very polite lady. And so at the end, made a point to ask her, so what did you understand? What was very similar? So she said, well, the idea of reincarnation, of course, is also in Buddhism. And when you were speaking about karma, I couldn't help but think this sounds very much like you're saying that karma binds the living entity to another body. And based on particular karma, one receives a body, and then so many events happen in the course of a life according to karma. And in the Buddhist understanding that I received when I was younger was desire binds us to material life and to suffering. And specifically, the emphasis is that desire is the root of suffering. Then I said, what's the alternative? Well, desirelessness is the root of freedom from suffering, and then release from the cycle of reincarnation. I responded two things and said that, well, there's a very close comparison, because before there's activity, there's desire. And if one can become free from desire for material enjoyment, then that's called liberation. Now, the other thing is, let me ask you a question. Who is it that becomes free from desire? She said, well, the soul, I guess. And I said, do you know that in Buddha's teachings, he doesn't mention the soul? He doesn't say that there isn't a soul. He doesn't say that there is a soul. He does speak about becoming free from desire and being conditioned by desire. But what's the seed of desire? Where does desire come from? Who is it that's desiring? So the idea of soul, that's a Christian concept or a Vedic concept, but it's not really in Buddhism. So now I have another question. When one becomes free from desire, what's that? She said, well, that's God. So are you saying that the soul becomes God? I never thought of it that way, but I suppose that that's what it's saying. And so being free from desire, that's a condition. It's not a person, it's a condition. And so this is a little bit where our ideology goes a little beyond that, or goes, you know, has some difference from this. So that condition where there is no desire means no desire for things material, and that's called the kingdom of God. It's the place where that condition exists. And souls become liberated that have no material desire, but have, now this is the nice part, they have a desire to serve God. And God desires to reciprocate with that love of those who want to serve Him in a loving way. She said, I like that teaching. That's very nice. And, okay, we'll go take a look at one of the books over on the book table there and see which one will help you understand that a little bit more. So, now it's a whole other thing. One advantage of preaching in America, because the family tie is not as strong, because one of the things that happens, even with those students that are from, there are actually a number of Oriental students that have become practicing devotees in the same manner, because the ideas are quite similar. But if they tried to do that right in Tokyo or right here in Singapore or someplace like that, so there's some advantage being in the wild, wild west. Some disadvantages too. So saguna, and here the word is aguna, so the Lord doesn't have material qualities. And if you read the Upanishads, it's very easy to get bewildered, because there's a very strong tendency in modern spiritual teachings, a very strong tendency towards impersonalism. So I've seen devotees who are nice devotees and strong devotees get bewildered when they start reading things that don't have purports in them. Even they know, but then they read something that doesn't have a purport and their mind goes blank or doubting. I've seen that. But the Bhagavatam is making it really easy for us to have a very clear, fundamental understanding of that terminology. And probably all of us have read, just because that's what's out there in the world, we've read some impersonal books or have heard it somewhere along the way, or both. And so it's important to be really clear about these things. And that's why they're being presented by Prabhupada, and why it's in the right here at the beginning, before the answers of citing the Lord's version. We're going to hear more about Brahma receiving knowledge from the personality of Godhead directly. Besides Tene Brahma Hridaya Adikavaye, he also imparted knowledge in this ninth chapter by directly speaking to Brahma. Then Narada heard it from Brahma, and Narada presented it to others. So Maharaj Parikshit goes on. He's still in the questioning mode. I wish to know. He wished to know the question of how did Narada propagate what he heard. Narrations concerning the Lord, who possesses wonderful potencies, are certainly auspicious for living beings in all planets. So it's glorification of Srimad Bhagavatam. So, in other words, it's appropriate. Hearing glorifications of a speaker, or of the subject matter of the speaker, or the disciplic succession from which the speaker comes, or any of those kinds of things, they're simultaneously appropriate and civilized, cultured. But they also, they're good to do because it opens the heart to receive in the most receptive mode the subject matter. O greatly fortunate, text 3, O greatly fortunate Shukadeva Goswami, please continue narrating Srimad Bhagavatam so that I can place my mind upon the Supreme Soul, Lord Krishna, and being completely freed from material qualities, thus relinquish this body. Purport to be fully engaged in hearing the transcendental narration described in the texts of Srimad Bhagavatam means to constantly associate with the Super Soul, the Supreme Soul, Sri Krishna, and to constantly associate with the Supreme Lord Krishna means to be liberated from the qualities of matter. Lord Krishna is like the sun, and material contamination is like darkness. As the presence of the sun dissipates darkness, constant engagement in the association of the Supreme Lord Krishna frees one from the contamination of material qualities. So this is the inverse of what the first text said. The first text said, describe that Lord who is free from material qualities, in this text as saying, one who is absorbed in that contemplation also becomes free from material qualities. So it's, the logic is, how can one become free from material qualities if your attention is on something of material quality? And then the practical part of that is, for those of us that struggle with involvement in qualities of passion, lust, anger, greed, delusion, bewilderment, and those kinds of things, we can try to counteract, or we can directly go beyond those qualities, or a combination of the two. Directly beyond those qualities is the devotional solution, the spiritual solution to all problems. So he's eager to hear, and in Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami says that a little attachment to any one of the five primary activities of bhakti, not primary, but five most potent activities of bhakti, can very quickly bring one to the stage of bhava, or spontaneous devotion. So you all know what those five most potent activities are, right? They're mentioned in Nectar of Devotion. So anybody doesn't know what the five are? Okay, because if you don't raise your hand and I ask you, then it means you'll be able to tell me what all five are. Anybody doesn't know what those five are? You don't know?
No.
Huh? You do know. Okay, why don't you say them?
What is duty service?
Worshipping the deity form of the Lord.
Associating with the devotees.
Associating with devotees. And specifically, it does say associating with devotees, but when we associate with devotees, we should try to serve the devotees when we're associating with them. Association?
Chanting of the Holy Name.
Chanting of the Holy Name. Chanting of the Holy Name. There's three. Two to go.
Then, residing in the holy places.
Like Singapore. Okay. Yeah. Hearing. Hearing, chanting, and discussing. Srimad Bhagavatam. So, a little attachment. On Sunday evening I spoke on this subject in relation to residing in a sacred place. So if you can't reside in a sacred place because you have to go to school over here in Singapore, then you can two things. You can make the place where you reside sanctified like a holy place, and by worshipping the deity, doing the same, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, chanting the holy name, serving the devotees, doing the same things that one would do with the other four categories, and specifically remembering. So something that enhances, as this paragraph we just read, remembering is enhanced by hearing and chanting. And of course, if one can do that all the time, then you're always remembering also. But if the activities are taken up in a regulative way, then remembrance can also remain with you. And specifically, the person that's the example of this one is Akrura, who just from a half day's journey in a bumpy chariot going from Mathura to Vrindavan, by remembering Krishna, and he had never met Krishna before because Akrura was a member of the Yadu dynasty. His father, anyway, so he was Krishna's uncle, and so that means he was in somehow in relation to Vasudev. Not exactly that they were Vasudev and Svakalpa or something like that was his father's name. Something like that. So, not that they were exactly brothers, Vasudev and Akrura's. And Akrura. But they're somehow they're amongst the Yadu dynasty. They're related. So he was living in Mathura because Mathura was the capital of the Yadus. In fact, Ugrasena was the king of the Yadus, and he was imprisoned and so forth by his beloved son, Kamsa. So the members of the Yadu dynasty were residing in Mathura, and who in Mathura saw Krishna after his birth? Vasudeva and Devaki only. And that was only for a short time. And then Vasudeva took him to Gokul, and that's it. No one saw him, but they certainly heard about him. Anyway, this nice narration, very wonderful narration of occurs. Hearing from Kamsa that I want you to bring Krishna to Mathura, and he was very explicit, and when he comes here I have a plan to kill him. In fact, here's my 5-part plan. He may not even make it here because I just sent Keshi and Vyomasura. But if he somehow gets past Keshi and Vyomasura, then when you bring him here, there's this, that, and that way that I'm planning to kill him. So my dear uncle, you've always been good to me. You just gave him some flattering words. And not that Okura went for the flattering words, but that he had a transcendental understanding of what was going on, because he understood Krishna was the personality of Godhead. And he knew that the prophecy was there that the 8th son of Devaki would kill me. He knew that that was Krishna, that was Krishna was going to kill him. So he was just assisting in Krishna's pastimes, bringing him to Mathura to kill Kamsa. So what he said to Kamsa was, "My dear Kamsa, don't be surprised if the plans that we make, if they're not sanctioned by providence, then they don't happen. Don't be surprised if just the opposite of what you're planning may happen. But because you're the king and I'm within the kingdom, it is my duty, I will carry out your request." And of course, Kamsa was very tuned in to diplomacy. He knew that if Akrura, the uncle of Krishna, invited him, well, he was Krishna's devotee. He knew that too. Krishna won't say no. So off Akrura went the next morning. And during the time, so this is the remembrance of the Holy Dham. As he was entering into the region of Vrindavan, his mind was just absorbed in thought of Krishna. And he was in prayers. Akrura achieved perfection through one of the 9 processes of bhakti, bandhanam, offering prayers. And the prayers are described. There's basically three divisions of those prayers. The first was identifying Krishna's position as God. You are the super soul within the heart of every living being. You are the source of the entire cosmic manifestation. During the period of cosmic manifestation, you maintain everything. Yeah, so he's just going on glorifying, identifying Krishna's supremacy. And he knew it very, very well. And the second part of his prayers were contemplating the very compromised situation he was in. He's Krishna's devotee, inviting Krishna to come for an attempted murder, which of course he knew wouldn't happen, but it was a very compromised position to be in nonetheless. So he was he went through, and you know, how will Krishna regard, and how do I feel about carrying out this ugly service? But then he considered Krishna is omniscient. He'll know what's in my heart. He'll know my motivation. He'll know my spirit of devotion. And he won't condemn me for this compromised position. In fact, It will enhance the confidentiality and intimacy of our relationship. So that's also there in his prayers. And then when he gets over that mood, then it's another mood, and that he's approaching Vrindavan and he's thinking what he'll see when he sees Krishna, because he's never seen Krishna. What he'll see, what he'll do, what Krishna will do, what Balaram will do. It gets really personal. And by that absorption, he starts experiencing bhava. And then there's one of the criterion described in Nectar Devotion, gets into the technical language of Nectar Devotion, but there are stimulations for ecstatic love. So we saw one stimulation. He saw the hoof prints of the calves in the dust of Vrindavan. He knew that Krishna is not far away. And then mixed with the hoof prints of the calves were the footprints of Krishna, with very distinct thunderbolt flag, rod for controlling elephants, and the symbols of Krishna in the dust of Vrindavan. And that was it. He was finished. The stimulation for ecstatic love, because his heart was absorbed in remembrance of Krishna in a prayerful mood, he fell out of the chariot and started rolling around. He lost control. He's very elderly, very stately. The Yadu dynasty, their royal family, he's rolling around the dust of Vrindavan, taking the dust and smearing it all over his body, and it's out of control. He's not like play acting or something like that, or imitating, or he's in an ecstatic mood. His whole body is trembling and he loses consciousness. Then he regains consciousness and he looks up and he sees it's milking time. It's really nice. It's milking time. And there's the cows, and he sees the cows getting ready for being milked, and then he sees Krishna and Balaram personally milking the cows, getting ready to milk the cows. They had come back from the day of herding the cows, and they had taken their bath, and they were in new, fresh garments. Krishna in his bright yellow dhoti, Balaram in his very nice blue dhoti, with fresh forest flower garlands, decorated with very brilliant jewels and ornaments, because Nanda and Jasoda wanted them to be dressed very nicely like that. And then he saw their, besides their general appearance, he got up and started approaching Krishna, could see his beautiful face, and the description is because he had heard about the beauty of Krishna. He understood that Krishna is all attractive, but when he saw the form of Krishna, it was beauty beyond imagination. And Krishna is just a young boy, and he's this, you know, with a beard, big Yadu, you know, controller. But he's Krishna's devotee. And again, bhava, seeing the form of the Lord, he lost it again. He went running before Krishna and Balaram and threw himself at their feet, and crying in ecstasy and sobbing and offering prayers. And Krishna, although he's a little boy, he's all powerful, and he picked up Uncle Akrura and just embraced him, and his body started trembling again and in ecstasy of love of God. And then Balaram, he came forward and he embraced Uncle Akrura, Anyway, and so on. They took him to have a meal and they received him as an honorable guest in all the appropriate ways. So, if we can't live in a holy place, of course, if you, when I mentioned to Sariputta that I was coming to Singapore, he said, "Oh, Lion City, Simhapur." I said, "I don't know if people think that's Lord Sringadev or they think it's tigers or something like that. Tigers and lions. So we can think about Lord Sringadev. It's a good thought to think of when you're in Singapore." And although we can't, while here we can't reside in Vrindavan, we can think of the pastimes of Krishna in Vrindavan and the holy land of Vrindavan, and a little attachment will develop symptoms of ecstasy, which means very quickly the reactions of our material baggage will be quickly dissolved. So Maharaj Parikshit is very anxious. He's attached to hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. Go on, more, more, so that I can become absorbed beyond the influence of the modes of material nature by these topics which are in themselves beyond the modes of material nature. Appropriately, the next paragraph Prabhupada speaks about don't hear from professional reciters, because even the topic is transcendental if it's heard from persons who are not attached and in a transcendental position. Then it will not have the same effect. Prabhupada does concede that such an audience hearing Srimad Bhagavatam from professional men can derive some material benefit as they desire. Shrinvata Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana. So that punya depends on the consciousness of the hearer. The topics of Srimad Bhagavatam are transcendental, and if one hears the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam from a pure devotee, even if one's consciousness is material, one will derive spiritual benefit. But if one from a professional reciter, one can get material benefit. Anyway, that's one of those, even if we're not qualified, if we get the good fortune of associating with pure devotees, we get spiritual benefit directly. And then the converse, we should be cautious about associating or hearing from those who are not in this. Hearing, simply repeating what was heard in disciplic succession. And Prabhupada reinforces it and says, not only is it good for us, but it's our duty. And it was spiritually aspiring. He had Shukadev Goswami to hear from. He was really fired up. He was really eager to hear from the most qualified speaker, so it's a great combination. And then text 4, very similar to one of the first canto verses, Shrinvata Shradhaya Nityam Vinatascha Svacheshtam Kalena Nati Dirgena Bhagavan Vishate Hudadi. persons who hear Srimad Bhagavatam regularly and are always taking the matter very seriously will have the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna manifested in their hearts within a short time. And it's a short purport, Prabhupada speaking about different grades of devotees and different results that come from the executing devotional service and those different grades of devotion. But the recommendation here is from the qualified speaker, hear regularly and you'll get maximum benefit. And then again, conversely, avoid hearing from those that don't receive the messages in disciplic succession. That's not recommended. Well, he goes on with some more questions. 14, 15. Yeah. Please explain this. Please describe that. What about this? Please explain that. Yeah. Right up to text 26. Well, text 5 I'll just do this one quickly, although it's a very, very wonderful verse. I refer to this verse, I think of this verse often and refer to it when speaking on Srimad Bhagavatam. Pravishthakarna Rundrina Svanam Bhava Saroruham Dhunoti Shamalam Krishna Salilasya Yata Sharat. So it's describing how this process works, the process of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. How does it act on the heart? And the verse is a metaphor which Prabhupada explains in the purport. And the long purport that comes in Chaitanya Charitamrita parallels this, the one of the Gundicha cleansing, Gundicha Marjana, from Rath Yatra pastimes with Lord Chaitanya. So the metaphor is, and this is something that you can easily relate to from your experience in India and people in the West, they have to imagine it just from describing it. But after the rainy season comes the Sharad season. So the summer season, then the rainy season, then the Sharad season. So that's in the verse. Salilasya Yata Sharad. So in the Sharad season, the heavy downpours of rain are over, but from the heavy downpours of rain, all the rivers are all muddy, and the reservoirs of water that collect from the rivers, they're also muddied, and they stay that way for some time. Well, the thing that clarifies them is a very light rain, and they're probably something that with the dynamics of physics can explain it, why the tension and the surface of the water with a light rain does something to the contents in the water, and the mud very quickly sinks to the bottom. So that's the metaphor. So like in the Sharad season, the muddy waters of the lakes and rivers become very quickly purified by the light rain in that season. So also the hearing of the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam very quickly pacify the heart and free the heart from the clutter of desire and agitated states of mind and so forth. And isn't it true? If we are slack in our hearing or discussing Krishna Katha, Not that I recommend that you do this, but you may have done this somewhere along the line because of work pressure or Maya or something. And automatically it makes the mind turbulent. And even ordinary things become aggravating and but then, on the other hand, even in the most difficult of circumstances, if one hears and there's some chanting, very sincere chanting, it's like this metaphor. It just very quickly dissipates from the heart. So much turbulence, like the mud stirred up from rainy season. We all have that experience. I'll share one of them with you that just happened recently. After the World Trade Center September 11th thing, people in New York City, it took about a week, just the streets were deserted. They blocked off the lower section of Manhattan, but they really didn't have to do that because nobody was around anyways. Cars weren't out, people weren't out, and that's not New York. New York is a very pedestrian city. Millions, millions, millions. And there was nobody. People were just shocked. Numb. They didn't go out. And then the week following that, we started going with two or three devotees to, but all around the city, in certain places in particular, but people were setting up makeshift altars, sometimes a Christian altar, sometimes a Buddhist altar, sometimes a this altar and that altar, and like candles and pictures and sayings, and they would go out and just hold hands and pray, and it became, everyone turned to God real fast. Because they didn't know, they had, you know, their life of complacency and enjoyment, and it was just shattered. You know, that this can happen, anything can happen at any time. So they were stunned. And I won't go into it. There were people that were at the location that even the devotees that are family members of devotees that work at the World Trade Center, and they saw the thing happen. It was so surreal, they just kept walking like they were going to go to work, go into the building that just got hit, because it just was too surreal to even relate. Well, look at that. They kept walking to go to work. Anyway, so week after, two, three devotees sat, no speaking, no books, just chanting, and very sedate, sitting down, harmonium, no, you know, just, and a little sheet of paper explaining, you know, we'll, this is providing some solace and suggesting spiritual counseling if you would like, and come to this address or contact that number. And then the following week, it was 3 weeks later, three weekends, so like 2.5 weeks after, I went with 15 devotees and we sat down, you know, facing each other on the pavement at Union Square Park, which has become the place where it's like the prayer vigil place for the city. And we just chanted. And within 10 minutes, there were about 100 people crowded around of all walks of life. We had a couple extra cushions, so some people came and sat on the cushions. A businessman wearing a suit and tie. It was on a Saturday, but still, he sat down and just closed his eyes and listened. And there was a peace demonstration going on, and some of those people came and sat right next to us. And then some kids that are musicians, like, I don't know if this means anything to you, but hardcore is what it's called. So they sat down and just started chanting with us. A French lady, very nicely dressed, she came and sat next to the Matajis and just chanting. An Oriental lady, she was just chanting and chanting, and tears were coming down her eyes, and you know, people's hearts were moved. Their emotional life was turned upside down and shaken around a bunch of times. And so they had no shelter, very bewildered, somewhere between angry and afraid and without direction and why and what to do and where to go and what to do with all these feelings, and very muddied waters. But the chanting of the holy name settled very quickly and touched people's hearts very deeply. We did the same thing the next day. The defense minister from India, based in Washington, made an appearance in New York, and he came to that same place, Union Square Park, and devotees chanted for about an hour and a half. And that was probably made more sense than anything anybody else up on the stage had to say, just because it was actual shelter. It wasn't just rhetoric. So, this is a nice verse. The sound incarnation of Lord Krishna, the Supreme Soul, i.e. Srimad Bhagavatam, enters into the heart of the self-realized devotee, sits on the lotus flower of his loving relationship, and thus cleanses the dust of material association, such as lust, anger, and hankering. Thus it acts like autumnal rains upon pools of muddy water. Karnarandrena, Pravishta Karnarandrena, that's how it starts. So it enters into the same way other sounds enter. It enters through the Karnarandrena, the whole cavity in the physical ear. But it goes, Prabhupada explains, it doesn't just go to the electrochemical processes of synapses sending things, some signal to the brain, but this specifically goes to the heart, spiritual sound vibration. It goes directly to the heart and it cleanses the heart, just as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Cheto Dharpana Marjanam, same as this Pravishta Karna Randrina Svanam. Bhava Saroruham Svanam, one's constitutional relationship becomes awakened. And bhava, feelings of spiritual happiness. Bhava Mahadev Bhagni Nirvapanam Shreyat Kairava Chandrika Vid. It acts directly on the heart. And what to speak if one is sincere and approaches that process with eagerness? So, we all have some degree of eagerness, and it's probably less than what we would like it to be. But whatever eagerness we bring to that activity, it's very powerful. This is a nice verse, chapter 9, text 5, glorifying the hearing process, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. It just doesn't happen the same way with the other yoga systems, Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Dhyan Yoga. It doesn't cleanse the heart like bhakti does. It does put one in touch with a higher sense of reality, that's for sure. And the differing degrees of detachment from the implications of material contact. But the cleansing of the heart and the spiritual ecstasy of contact of the soul directly with the Supreme Soul in a mood of devotion, nothing else compares. It doesn't act the same. The subjective experience is not the same. So the gopis, when Krishna calls them to come in the dead of the night by playing upon his flute, and their hearts become attracted and they come running, leaving the sides of their family members and so forth, and Krishna says, this isn't very good, you should go back home and practice meditating upon me within your heart, the gopis don't like to hear this. How can you do this? Tell us to go back and practice Dhyan Yoga and Gyan Yoga. Don't be so cruel. They have no interest in those things. Their interest is their loving attraction for Krishna. So by this process of hearing, that loving attraction for Krishna and the cleansing of the heart take place unlike anything else. Prabhupada concludes, whereas other methods may be superficially good for the time being, there is a risk of becoming muddy again due to agitation of the mind. Devotional service to the Lord with specific attention for hearing Srimad Bhagavatam regularly and always is the best recommended method for liberation from the clutches of illusion. Okay, so now it's 10:20. Any discussion? Questions?
Chaturshloki Bhagavatam or Chaturshloki Bhagavad Gita, they contain the principle, but all the details, like most of the verses, other verses could also elaborate the principles given in Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita, while that particular set of verses is set Chaturshloki Bhagavad Gita or Chaturshloki Bhagavatam.
Why not another four? That's what you're saying?
No, my is what is the
criterion?
Gives the essence of all the things. Or?
Well, Chaturshloki, the essential instructions for Srimad Bhagavatam, they come in four consecutive verses. They're uttered directly by the Supreme Lord. They're concise statements. And if you analyze them, they go sequentially, same as Chaturshloki Bhagavad Gita. I've given a course for 1 week long in both Chaturshloki Bhagavad Gita and Chaturshloki Bhagavatam, and they're just so full. A week isn't enough just to discuss those four verses. But and it's very clear, they're sequential. They're each responding to specific areas of teaching. They're not necessarily a question and then the corresponding answer question, but it covers the range in a very concise manner. It is what Vyasadeva compiled as the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam, and we hear that it's the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam. So, at least the first part of your question, the first way you phrased the question, was couldn't we consider something else to also express the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam? And one could make an argument for that. One could make an argument for the fact that in each word of Srimad Bhagavatam there's volumes and volumes of meaning, what to speak of each sloka. But it is what Vyasa, you know, the other things are also there. There are four in a row, spoken by the Supreme Lord. It is what Vyasadeva composed or compiled first. It meets the criterion. Logic, it can extend the other way, if so. Those are the Chaturslokhi verses, which means that anything else connects with it. You like to find something in Srimad Bhagavatam that presents a conclusion different than the Chaturslokhi verses. So the reverse is, any one of them could, they resonate with or are in harmony with the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam as expressed in the Chaturslokhi verses. We could take one of the other ones. But that's not what our acharyas have done. It's not what Vyasadeva did. Anything else? Yeah.
Maharaj, you were mentioning that this process of sincere hearing and chanting immediately pacifies the mind, pacifies the thing. In the beginning stage of devotion service, it's easier to sing.
This is your classic question.
Like, even nowadays when I chant and things like that, there's a lot of disturbance going in the mind. So what are some steps we can take to execute this process so that the effect can be pacifying of the mind and heart.
Let me ask you, can you summarize the answers that you've been given over the weeks and months and years to answer that question? What do you understand from the answers that you've received when you've asked that question in the past, or something like that question in the past? Do you recognize that you've asked that question in the past? Okay. Or something related to that type of a question. I remember it, so I'm asking if you remember it. Yeah. So then the essence or some of the highlights that you heard in the past, what are they?
We make some advancement, and then gradually we become proud of that, and we start making offenses based on some advancement we make, and that's why the mercy is withheld.
attitude of taking for granted in devotional service. So once we receive something which is very nice, which is not so easily available to us, we become complacent. We don't realize the mercy we have received. So that's why the
okay. You probably, if you sat, you know, in a quiet place and could ponder on this, you would probably come up with some other understandings that you've been... I'd like to modify the second and the third. Or even modify the first one. It's not that in the beginning there's some special mercy that is a one-time deal. The sun shines equally. Krishna's mercy similarly is equally distributed. But there's a certain quality in the situation of the life of someone who is newly contacting Krishna consciousness. And that is, they're very eager for some alternative. That's the key thing. That's a key factor, which is the opposite of it is complacency or taking for granted. Then, so that's one modification. Then another is that after some time the fruits become like Krishna withholds them a little bit. Krishna doesn't withhold them a little bit. It doesn't become harder to secure Krishna's mercy. Rather, according to Madhurya Kadambini, the end nectar of devotion, or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the nature of devotional service is very, very powerful. So much so that it can eradicate the reactions of our past misdeeds very quickly. But we run the... So the first two sources of impurities of heart or anarthas are past piety and past impiety. They're very quickly counteracted by bhakti. But when we begin bhakti, then we have the chance, which we didn't have before, taking up bhakti, to make some mistakes and some offenses, for which we then get some cloud blocking, some anartha blocking our experience of Krishna's descending mercy. It's not that the mercy becomes more difficult, it's there's something blocking it, and that something that's blocking it is due to our negligences and inattentiveness and offenses in bhakti. That's why it gets harder, is because of from our side, not from Krishna's side. That's part two. So that's the special mercy at the beginning is we haven't made any mistakes yet. And then the third is not being sufficiently respectful or becoming complacent, which goes back to the first. What is our impetus? What is it that we want? In the beginning, what does somebody want? Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita what people want. They want relief from distress. Or they want economic betterment. or they're curious, or they want knowledge. And when any one of those four things or combination of them are satisfied, see you later, Krishna. I got what I wanted. Or maybe one might not check out, or one may not submit oneself with the same enthusiasm as the initial impetus was there. And therefore, it's incumbent upon Pankaj and others who have been practicing Krishna consciousness for a little while to have new, refreshed motivation or impetus for bhakti. Besides 1, 2, 3, 4. And that is, I really want to serve Krishna. Or at least to maintain myself in a condition of pure existence, mode of goodness. I must, for the sake of purity, I must submit myself to Krishna as his servant. And higher is, and I must because it's my constitutional position. And I have a choice, that the default choice is, I won't. And that, I know what that's all about, so I'm not going to do that. But then, if you place yourself in the middle ground, I don't choose to leave serving Krishna, but I don't choose to submit myself in his loving service either. I'm just treading water. What happens when you tread water and the river's moving downstream swiftly? You get carried with the current. So then you have to, then there's some endeavor. And depending upon, this is back to the first one, depending upon the sincerity of purpose, the endeavor becomes a burden or the endeavor becomes ecstasy. The ecstasy is where you know Krishna is carrying you against the current and towards him. And then endeavor, and it's more ecstatic and more ecstatic. It's not a problem. But neglecting that higher motivation or purpose, and then it becomes a burden, a resentment, what's going on, how come, and so forth. There's a greater responsibility for those that aren't just beginners. Neglect your greater responsibility, it becomes harder. It's the carrying the consciousness of the materialist, kartaham iti manyate, into the realm of bhakti, which doesn't match. I'm going to create my advancement. It doesn't work. Then it's a burden. There isn't taste. Struggle. Struggle in a bad way. Well, that's struggling a bit. Well, struggle in a way that's someone who's striving for advancement, they'll also struggle, but it's joyful. Joyful because I can experience Krishna's reciprocation. Let the struggles keep rolling in. That's okay, because Krishna's reciprocation, that's what I'm hankering for. I'm not just hankering so that I can become an advanced devotee, because when I become an advanced devotee, I won't have to struggle anymore. And then everyone will think, wow, there's such an, and you know, it's, and many more things. But that's another anartha, thinking about respect and appreciation and position, and that's another anartha. So, just being in reciprocation, being in a position where I'm Krishna is reciprocating with my endeavors. That's what I want. That relationship, conscious relationship with Krishna. So it's actually very important to reassess what is my impetus for devotional service. Or as I said to a couple of devotees recently, rejoin the Hare Krishna movement. Not in the literal sense, but in the sense of reassess and recommit, like it's a new event. Refresh. They have that on your computer, right? Refresh. You know, just make it all whatever was this, and then start clean. Now why am I taking up devotional service? What would I like my life to be? And there should be a new sense of that as time passes and practice passes and understanding passes and purification takes place. We should become more mature in our sense of why. And then, with the enthusiasm of newness, there's part two. One is the concept of why I should, then the other is the commitment to do so. Because the same impetus isn't there of suffering, being deluded, being lost, having no spiritual orientation whatsoever. Just flapping around like a leaf in the wind. So we don't have that, so then that's the complacency. Lacking in submission. Bhakti Siddhanta speaks about that one. It's lacking in submission is connected to, but it's not identical with, lacking in appreciation. For the gifts that we've been given. And it's they certainly go naturally together. But submission is what Bhakti Siddhanta identifies. Pranipat. And in the Sharanagati topic that we'll be discussing in the evening, it's the Atma Nivedana. It's self-surrender. If that's not there, then it's mechanical. It's hard to maintain mechanical. So that this question doesn't become a place that you get stuck in, you need to apply these understandings in a practical way. Anything else? Wasn't a risk at all. Everyone over there is all thinking risk. As I said at the airport, I think it's a lot safer here than there. I was very selfish. thinking of bodily comfort, this is much safer. Who's going to do anything in Singapore? I mean, they might do something, but this is much safer. It's a long journey, that's for sure. Shiva Prabhupada ki jai.